Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, anti-Muslim sentiment in the San Joaquin Valley. We'll get an inside perspective from one local Islamic leader and get some new insights into the fight against ISIS. We'll also talk to Luis Chavez, the new leader of the Fresno Unified School District Board of Trustees. This in the wake of the ongoing federal investigation into the district's no-bid construction contracts and other concerns about the future of the largest school district in the valley. Right now, though, we turn our attention to the world of agriculture. Valley farmers are known for producing some of the finest fruits, vegetables, and nuts in the world. But what if big agriculture here also included marijuana? If the legalization of recreational pot makes it onto the November 2016 ballot and passes, local growers might have a new crop to harvest. FM 89's Ezra David Romero reports that some Central Valley farmers are already eyeing just that possibility.
A few years ago, Los Banos farmer Kevin Michael discovered a one-acre illegal marijuana grow on his land.
They'd made reservoirs and they were pumping water. They'd buried generators. They had this whole encampment, and we knew nothing about it.
He says the forbidden plantation was worth around $19 million. That's more than his 11,000 acres of tomatoes, cotton, and other crops gross in 1 year. That got him thinking.
So if that's a market that's viable, I think we definitely would look at it. So I don't know. I guess if I thought if I put in a 200-acre planting of marijuana, would the market sustain that?
But this idea of cannabis becoming a major player in mainstream agriculture is contingent on California voters. There's a very good chance backers of legalizing marijuana will gather enough signatures to put a measure on the ballot next fall. If it passes, growers like Michael would still face significant hurdles. The state would need time to develop regulations. Local laws could further restrict growing, and cannabis would still be illegal under federal law. Still, becoming a big grower early on could make sense for farmers like Michael, who have land and resources.
To me, it's just another potential option for something that could be a benefit to the farm and continue to help us, you know, rotate properly and then also make some money, hopefully.
But small farmers already growing legal medical marijuana aren't necessarily dreaming of a California with rolling hills of pot, especially if big growers eventually push out smaller existing farms.
I don't really see any clear benefit. It doesn't seem like it's been terribly good for the natural resources or the people of California.
That's Hezekiah Allen with the California Growers Association, representing over 500 members. He says a strain of cannabis called hemp, which has low levels of THC, may be beneficial to farm on a large scale. Hemp can be used to make paper, clothing, and even soaps.
So I think there's absolutely a role for big industrial commercial production. I think there will always be a role for the smaller craft producers if we take the time to get it right.
If large farmers focus on hemp, Allen hopes that growers already cultivating marijuana for medicinal use won't be harmed. At the moment, cultivation is legal for medical purposes, but the actual number of plants a medical marijuana cardholder can grow is limited and varies by county. For example, in Sonoma, a cardholder can grow up to 30 plants. All 8 Central Valley counties refer to statewide requirements for growing, 6 mature plants or 12 immature plants. Growing weed also takes a lot of water, but not quite the 400 gallons it takes to grow a pound of almonds. Allen says it takes 140 gallons of water to grow a pound of pot. Law enforcement also plays a big role in growing practices. Take Fresno County, where Sheriff Margaret Mims has waged an all-out war on marijuana, closing down hundreds of illegal grows.
For me, it really started out as the violence issue. Home invasion robberies, the homicides, the assaults with a deadly weapon, all of that started increasing in these large marijuana grows.
Her officers have encountered gangs, booby traps, and military-grade weapons at grow sites. She also says marijuana has negative effects on human health. If cannabis becomes legal in California, Mims says she's afraid violence will get out of hand.
If we again start allowing people to have these large grows, the violence will go up again. We have to take into consideration how we reconcile the difference between state law and federal law.
She hopes whatever initiative passes includes some sort of control by local enforcement.
As long as that happens, we're all going to come out ahead, because then cities and counties can make up their own minds about what they want to do with their own land use ordinances.
She also doesn't think existing growers will want to pay taxes and fees that come with legalization. Others, like Christian Long in Fresno, are looking forward to the full legalization of the crop. He's the vice president of the Fresno-based hydroponics company, Current Culture H2O. They sell systems that people use to grow all sorts of plants, but most of his business is from people who grow cannabis. Today he's working on a system with 12 tubs connected together with PVC pipes, this time growing broccoli.
This is 12 sites total. So the roots just grow right down into the water.
Long says they're currently working on a modular system that could be used on a large scale.
Now we're at the point where a lot of our new business actually is these commercial growers. We're not leaving the hobby segment, but we're creating a whole new segment in our business that's specifically for commercial.
He says he thinks it will take about 10 years for cannabis to catch on as a large regulated crop.
If the laws do change, I think that we're going to see a kind of a reemergence of home growers, specifically people that want to grow their own medicine.
But Long says that's just the beginning. He hopes for a boom come late 2016. And to get ready for the influx of orders, Current Culture H2O is expanding to a 30,000 square foot building to accommodate future business. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
This is Valley Edition. The San Bernardino terror attacks earlier this month sparked a massive law enforcement and intelligence community response. They also sparked a response of a different sort, the return of anti-Islamic rhetoric. Earlier this month, officials are investigating a potential arson blaze in an Islamic center in Palm Springs. Two mosques in Hawthorne were vandalized. A severed pig's head was thrown at the doorstep of a mosque in Philadelphia. Joining us now to talk about this new concern of anti-Islamic rhetoric, we have Imam Sayyid Ali Ghazvini. He is the Imam of the Islamic Cultural Center of Fresno. Welcome to Valley Edition.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
We want to talk about some of these issues and also some insights into ISIS. We've talked about some of this before, but in a heightened way now after these most recent attacks and also the attacks in Paris. When your community gathers after one of these attacks in San Bernardino, what is the mood like? I imagine it must be somber, not just for the terrible tragedy that unfolded, but also for the fear of the types of responses that you might see in the community.
Yes, it's a mixed emotions. We are outraged because these crimes being carried out under the name of our faith, or they claim to follow our faith. So we are angry. We reject that. We denounce that. On the other side, also, we are seeing a rise in Islamophobia and targeting our faith and targeting our community. And actually, this is impacting us. There are a lot of concerns, security concerns, but most importantly, it's targeting our youth, our, school-going boys and girls, especially at elementary schools, how they receive certain remarks from their classmates. That is concerning us and significantly.
Both after the attacks in Paris and in San Bernardino, President Obama called on the Muslim community in America to do more to root out those who may support violence or extremist views. I want to play a clip now from an NPR report by Tom Jelton, which aired late last week on this station. And let's listen in.
Palestinian-American activist Linda Sarsour works with the Black Lives Matter movement and other minority groups. She's firmly committed to interfaith cooperation. But she was a bit offended by President Obama's message to Muslims.
We would never ask any other faith community to stand up and condemn acts of violence committed by people within their groups. And the fact that this is only directed at the Muslim community is something that I personally can't accept.
In his Sunday night message, the president did say Muslim Americans should not be treated differently, but administration officials are not retreating from their request that Muslims assist in counterterrorism efforts. Speaking at a mosque outside Washington yesterday, Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson said he'll keep defending American Muslims from discrimination, but then he asked for something in return.
It is an ask of the people in this room and all Muslims across this country.
Terrorist groups, he said, are seeking to pull your youth into the pit of violent extremism.
Help us to help you stop this.
Let's talk about the president's message there and the message from the administration. Do you share the sentiment from the woman who was first quoted in that piece that in some way this is an unfair criticism of?
Yes, absolutely. You know, we've been partners with Valley Public Radio for many years now. I think we do our job in the best manner we can. We've been denouncing terrorism. We've been raising this education about how our faith is promoting peace, understanding, and dialogue. But yet, unfortunately, there are people who still believe that we are not doing enough. There was a survey in the Fresno area that almost more than 80% of the population think that we are not doing enough. This is alarming. Continuously we are, reaching out. We are talking, whether within our center or on the media or our social media, emphasizing on peace and how we need to live together. Yet, unfortunately, at moments after these attacks, we get to have these opinions. You know what? Everyone needs now work together. We do have a concern. Let's sit and talk and see why such phenomena is being created close to home or at home.
You mentioned Valley Public Radio. In the interest of disclosure, I think what you're talking about is your organization, along with many churches and other groups, sponsor messages on this station. And that is one thing that you do. You've sponsored things with the police chief and others here locally. But I think the president was talking about more of an internal focus on what is the community doing internally to address maybe people who are at risk of potentially being influenced by extremist ideology.
Well, you see, I was in Iraq for about 5 months last year. And when I came back, I told everyone, listen, we have a serious issue ahead of us. We need to address it within our community, in large, and within our nation. This is the dangers of ISIS. And I said, we have to counter it in an educational, that's our job, educational. So I think Muslim communities are doing excellent in this manner. To have an exception, one person out of, 4, 5, 6, 7 million Muslims in this country to be extremist, we need to study it. Why? He's been, he or his wife, being the example of San Bernardino I'm talking about. Why? What kind of link they have to extremism outside the United States, Wahhabism? So this is an issue for a study, really. Throwing accusations here and there is not going to help us. It's going to impact us and others.
And the rhetoric in that area has reached a new high lately with the comments, of course, most prominently from Donald Trump, but others as well. I want to bring into the conversation now another voice. He is Mark Andrew Levine, a professor of Middle East history at UC Irvine. He most recently has a commentary talking about the U.S. government response through policies like the change to the visa waiver program on Al Jazeera. Mr. Levine, nativist politics are nothing new in American history. Is there anything different about this most recent call for not sanctions, but steps against Muslims and the Islamic community?
Well, I think it's certainly heightened. I think that, you know, Islamophobia has been an industry, you know, that has been increasingly powerful over the last 20 years. It's tied to, you know, right-wing, very conservative think tanks and pundits and commentators. And, you know, it goes back to a kind of clash of civilizations idea that is popularized by people like Bernard Lewis and Samuel Huntington for decades, that, you know, that there are these completely different and incompatible civilizations that can only interact like billiard balls smashing against each other and really don't affect each other or shape each other in any positive way. And, you know, the people who developed this discourse, for example, Samuel Huntington, were mass murderers. He's the man responsible for the idea of carpet bombing Vietnam and killing hundreds of thousands of people in order to push them into the cities where they could be better, they thought they could better control them. So, I mean, from the beginning, this kind of idea has been awash in blood. It's been awash in racism, and it's been awash in war and militarism. And, you know, that's kind of the irony when, you know, you think Trump and the blatant racism of Trump, but I would support what the woman from Black Lives Matter, the Palestinian activist, said. You know, it's certainly true that Muslims, like anyone, have to root out the root out any kind of violence in their midst. But, of course, the U.S. government is responsible for the vast majority of violence. It's responsible for a million dead Iraqis, pretty much, in terms of its invasion of Iraq. We've supported every corrupt, brutal, murderous regime from Morocco straight to Pakistan. Our best friends are the Saudis, who, you know, behead and crucify people in the streets and kill far more people than ISIL. So, you know, it's and every other dictatorship, so not to mention the Israeli occupation. So if this is, you know, that's what causes terrorism, we know that because our own intelligence agencies have said that. So for President Obama, who absolutely knows this, to say, you know, that Muslims need to do more to root out violence, when the U.S. government is knee-deep in it for decades, is disingenuous, to say the least. And that, you know, the question is, how do you get the American people to understand that? How do you get Jewish people to understand or Christian people to understand our own complicity in the violence that gets done in our name, right? Just as we expect Muslims to speak out against the violence done in their name. Without that level of understanding, this is, you know, never going to happen, and this kind of prejudice is just going to increase.
Doesn't that, in some way, if you accept that particular view, doesn't that in some way then give ISIL or ISIS some legitimacy in their attacks, if you're saying that these are justified in
no,
some way?
No, absolutely. There's no legitimacy for terrorism. You know, that's a violation of international law. Never mind that everyone does it, but it's still a violation of international law, and it's a horrendous crime, and certainly no one would support it. But if you want to, you know, if you want to know how to, if you want to stop terrorism, you have to address the roots of terrorism. Among the roots of terrorism, Muslim terrorism, if you want to just limit it to that, certainly there's an ideology, as Imam said, you know, going back to Wahhabism and this very chauvinistic version of Islam that has been spread by the Saudis with all their oil money everywhere. But it also lies in occupation. It lies in the support for undemocratic, brutal regimes. It lies in, you know, militarism. I mean, Hillary Clinton's biggest donors are the defense contractors. I mean, if this is our political system where, you know, you have tens of billions of dollars of weapons sold and given to all these brutal, corrupt regimes that then repress their people, who then, when they have no other democratic ways to resist, ultimately move towards violence, then you're not really going to address the problem. It's like trying to put a Band-Aid on a gunshot. It's just not going to do anything.
UC Irvine Professor Mark Levine, will return to him in a moment. I want to turn back to our in-studio guest, Imam Syed Ali Ghazvini of the Islamic Cultural Center of Fresno. I want to talk a little more about some insights into ISIS. We often hear hand in hand when we talk about ISIS this idea that they have to establish a caliphate, their declaration of one, setting aside their present-day ambitions, which I think are pretty clear in their murderous ways. I'm curious more about the origins of that term and what does that really mean in the context of Islamic history when we talk about a caliphate, because I don't think there's a lot of context there that most Western Americans are aware of.
Well, the historical model of Islamic State used to be called caliphate. Basically, it has its origin in faith, but in many stages of history, actually violated the tenets of the faith. So it was basically a political regime. Let's take the Ottoman Empire, who called themselves caliphate, and they expanded their power. They were brutal themselves, and so unfortunately, there are among a few minority of Muslims who still dream of bringing a might to their power. And ISIS is actually playing this game. ISIS is a group of criminals. The leaders of ISIS are ex-Saddam Army officers who actually are riding this wave of, feeling some kind of interest in getting their history back. ISIS is rooted in what is called Wahhabism, a very radical form of ideologies and thoughts, started in the harshest desert in the world. And now they want to gain the power throughout terror, raising terror and creating terror in the hearts of everyone to blackmail and to rule. So today, 99% of Muslims, they do not support this idea at all. They reject this idea. Muslims themselves are victims of ISIS. I don't know what percentage, but the overwhelming majority of the victims of ISIS are Muslims, Shia Muslims, people in the area, Yazidis, Christians. Absolutely, they are against this idea of caliphate and ISIS taking over parts or influencing parts of the world.
The other day I was reading an article on the online magazine Quartz, and it said ISIS has done something rather remarkable. The one thing that it has done is united other Muslim groups that are very disparate and don't agree on a lot of things, united them against the fact that they do not speak for Muslims and this idea of them leading this.
They are considered a danger. Not only they don't speak on our behalf, they are considered a serious danger against Muslims and against the world.
When a lot of the talk over recent weeks, especially after Paris was involving Syrian refugees to America and America's response, Donald Trump has called, of course, most notably to ban all Muslims entering the country. I want to, though, talk more specifically about your community's experience with Syrian refugees. I understand there are some who have come here to California. What can you tell us about that process and the families that you know?
Most of us are immigrants. A lot of, including among us, there are a few who are born or raised here. And some of us are refugees from before, from the Iraq war, from Afghanistan. And now there is a wave from Syrian, Assyrians because of the violence in their country. And it is really very sad that when it comes to this human tragedy in Syria and how people are escaping for their life and for the life of their children and women, now we say we need to close the door against them. It's really sad and hurting. You know, we have this example, a family, a young girl, 4 years old, including in this family, a a person who is over 65 years old, a lady who is an attorney there, to say that they create a danger against our society does not make sense at all. And, you know, and we are really sad to hear about all these rhetorics against refugees.
Turning back to Professor Levine, who joins us on the phone from UC Irvine today. Last week, the U.S. House passed a bill making big changes to the visa waiver program for people with dual citizenship in Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Sudan. There's also a Senate bill that would apply other changes to people who have visited Iraq or Syria. You write that this visa waiver change is simply not going to achieve the result that its backers intend, that it's ineffective. Why is that?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure what results they actually intend, because to throw Iran and Sudan on a list of countries sponsoring ISIL, you know, if we're worried about ISIL, there's no ISIL in Iran. So and Sudan, whatever the problems with the government, you know, is not a very nice government. It's involved, it's been involved in genocide in Darfur, et cetera, but it's certainly not sponsoring ISIL in any meaningful way right now. And yet Saudi Arabia and Turkey, the two biggest facilitators of ISIL's growth and spread in Syria and Iraq, are not on the list. And, of course, everyone knows that. So, again, when this happens, and everyone knows this is a joke, then you have to start asking, why are they doing this? They can't actually want to deal with this stuff, because they would have developed a bill that they would have included countries that actually mattered. But, you know, Sudan and Iran, you can say whatever you want and do whatever you want to them because they don't have a constituency. Saudi Arabia has a huge constituency in this country, and in terms of in Washington especially. This Turkey is one of our NATO allies, and we need its support. So the countries, this is the problem. The countries that are most deeply involved in supporting ISIL are our biggest allies. And, you know, instead of stepping back and saying, why are we supporting these groups that are sponsoring, these countries that are sponsoring, or governments rather, that are sponsoring groups that are attacking us? Maybe we should change our policies to them. We come up with these kinds of policies which do nothing except confuse people and cause people who don't deserve to be inconvenienced to harm. And that, I think, shows really the bankruptcy of the entire counterterrorism discourse in this country.
And one other thing before we go, and I want to get both of your thoughts on this. There's been a lot of talk about Muslim immigrants to America, to the West. If you look at the terrorist attacks in Paris, most of the attackers there were European nationals. In the case of San Bernardino, Mr. Farouk was an American citizen. Is there perhaps a danger in paying too much attention to immigrants and not enough attention to the threat of homegrown terror, whether it's Islamic or other sources?
Well, I think so. And I think, first of all, you know, his wife, Farouk's wife, did not come in as a refugee. I mean, refugees are the most thoroughly vetted migrants or immigrants to this country. It takes 18 months often, if not more than 2 years, to get in as a refugee. The last way any terrorist would try to get in as a refugee, as this or she came in through a waiver program for fiancés or married people. Now, they're not going to touch that, because that would violate the idea of marriage, which all the Republicans support, et cetera. So the thing that was used and abused to come in, we don't touch. But the thing that has nothing to do with this, which is allowing refugees, and I work with a lot of refugees in Europe, especially Syrians and Iraqis in Sweden and Denmark, and, you know, what they've gone through is horrific. And to punish them when the evidence clearly shows that they're not the problem, again, just shows, makes you wonder, what are we doing? You know, what are we actually trying to do here? When every possible thing we could do that would actually help, we do the opposite that doesn't help. That's the question we should be asking our elected officials.
And Imam Ghazvini, your thoughts on that issue of the concern over Muslim immigrants when, in many cases, those who have undertaken these sorts of attacks in America and abroad are homegrown?
This is another sad situation, unfortunately. You know, Muslim immigrants in this country, let me talk about my own community, just an example. You know, I have doctors who are serving in the poorest area of this town, giving healing and healthcare treatment to a lot of people who are in poverty. We have immigrants who their business, it's a franchise, the most growing franchise in the nation, and creating jobs and contributing to our economy. We have farmers. We have nurses who save lives every single day. Such statements against immigration in general, and especially targeting Muslims, is actually undermining and ignoring their contribution to this. We are part of this society, and they are contributing in a very positive way. What happened with San Bernardino, just an example, we would like to know how they got radicalized. We really would like to know. His wife was in Saudi Arabia, apparently being radicalized there by Wahhabism, and now she comes here, she radicalized her husband, and now we're talking about 5 to 7 million Muslims in the nation that they could be a source of threat to our security. It doesn't fall, really. This is a case that we need to target and study. And they have nothing to do with what the House last week approved about visas. You know, they targeted, an example, Iran or Sudan. Iran has nothing to do. I don't remember a Shia Muslim being in an act of terrorism or extremism. I really don't remember. This is not the right approach to solve this issue, extremism within our nation or within the Muslim community or around the world. We need to really sit together and have Muslims also with us, not to tell them, you know, you have not done your job in this. We need to sit together, listen to one another, and address this major concern that is impacting us. I think we are suffering more than others, especially our kids now. We are suffering, we are outraged because we are now fighting on two levels. One, trying to educate ourselves and others that Islam is a religion of peace. And then tell everyone, your neighbor, your Muslim neighbor, is not ISIS. He is against ISIS as much as you are.
And before we go, there's been some talk out there in some circles after Trump made his remarks in regards to Muslim immigration to America that this plays into ISIS's hand. Do you believe that that's the case? Is that something that could serve as recruiting fodder for ISIS? Or is that immaterial at this point? They have enough recruiting fodder out there as it is. Does this Islamophobic backlash
absolutely fit? Absolutely.
Is this a cyclical?
I personally believe, I could be wrong, I don't know. I personally believe ISIS wants to have a voice in American election. They deliberately attack the vulnerable, the women, the children, the disabled, so they provoke someone to, you know, backlash. Either, you know, God forbids, attack a mosque, or for an American politician to come and say that, look, that's what Muslims all are about. You know, they are extremists, this and that. This is exactly falls in the game of ISIS. This is what ISIS wants, really. If we are responding, if someone is responding in an outrageous way and make all Muslims guilty of that, this is what ISIS wants.
Imam Sayyid Ali Ghazvini of the Islamic Cultural Center of Fresno with us today. Also on the phone, Mark Andrew Levine. He is a professor of Middle East history at UC Irvine. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll be back in just a moment with more of Valley Edition and also talk to Fresno Unified School District Board President Luis Chavez just took that office. We'll talk about the future of the district as it has been rocked by scandal in recent months. That's coming up on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. California is one of just a few states looking to curb the influence of outside spending in elections. With few tools to govern the unlimited sums of money groups can spend, independent groups will likely pour billions of dollars into next year's campaigns. Capital Public Radio's Ben Bradford explains how California regulators are pushing back.
At a recent white tablecloth event at a posh Sacramento hotel, 40 candidates for statewide office listened attentively as representatives from California's most influential political groups explained what their money can do. Opposition research, said Alma Hernandez of California's largest union.
We know why you got divorced, when, if you got a traffic violation when you were 16.
Which they can use to attack opponents, said Liza Garcia of the California Association of Realtors.
We will probably take care of the negative if the research tells us it will work.
And candidates should probably meet with them, or else, said Janice Norman of the California Medical Association.
Now I'm making a decision, is it worth the effort to get enjoined in an IE and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to make sure that you're not here?
An IE is an independent expenditure group. Since the U.S. Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision, these groups can spend unlimited funds in elections, whether they're labor unions, business interests, advocacy organizations, or generic patriotic-sounding committees with murky donors. The California Fair Political Practices Commission estimates outside groups spent $80 million last election cycle. Chairwoman Jody Remke says that's only increasing.
Candidates and their committees know this is where to go. So they're going to do what they can to encourage independent spending. So we have seen trends, and we're trying to go after those trends.
While states can't limit the spending, they can bar these groups from communicating, strategizing, or the word is coordinating with candidates who do have contribution limits. Still, coordination happens all the time.
It's just so tempting because the money is out there.
Gary Winnick spent years as California's top elections enforcement agent, but he only remembers two busts for coordination.
These were very, very difficult cases to prove. Everyone who's involved in them are obviously all basically on the same team.
And there are some well-known ways to get around both state and federal laws. Candidates fundraise for an allied outside group, or a staffer quits the campaign to join the IE, or they share political consultants. Or how about this? Campaigns post a video online of the candidate shaking hands, looking decisive, smiling with the spouse, sometimes with uplifting music, like this one from North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis. But there are no words. Independent groups then pull the footage and use it in an outside ad.
Are you kidding? That's not coordination.
Remke scoffs, but outright banning these strategies could conflict with the Supreme Court rulings. So some states are cracking down in another way. Instead of having to prove coordination, Minnesota, Maryland, Connecticut, and Arizona assume it when candidates and outside groups fundraise together. It's up to the campaigns to prove they're not coordinating. As of October, California goes further. Its new anti-coordination law also assumes guilt when groups share staff, consultants, or ad footage. Winnick says it's probably the toughest in the nation.
Having coordination, these coordination regulations will go a long way towards making sure that candidate contribution limits are more real.
The rule also has its detractors. The California Political Attorneys Association argues some aspects are onerous to candidates. Republican political consultant Mike Madrid agrees, and he has a philosophical objection.
And let's keep something in mind. As long as there has been government, there's been money trying to influence politics and influence government, and there always will be. So let's be clear about that. The goal should not be to try to chase all of this money out of politics. It should be able to shine a bright light on it so everyone knows what's going on.
Madrid says limits just drive money further into the shadows. In an interesting twist, he and Winnick have teamed up. The two unlikely allies are pushing a ballot initiative next year that wouldn't affect coordination, but would more tightly track spending. Their goal, to pull some of that money back out of the shadows. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Bradford.
This is Valley Edition. The Fresno Unified School District is the largest school district in Central California. It has a new leader this week. Luis Chavez has been elected president of the board. This as it is still undergoing a federal investigation into the district's use of no-bid construction contracts. Other concerns about district leadership. Here to tell us about his priorities for the district in this challenging time, Luis Chavez joins us on the phone. Luis, welcome.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate the opportunity to come in and speak to your audience.
Certainly the stories about the district's current issues have been well documented in the media. They have played out on the front pages of the Fresno Bee on this station and other outlets. There's thousands of employees, though, and tens of thousands of students out there in schools each and every day. What's the morale like in the district right now as all of this plays out?
Well, I think, you know, for our district, it's important that we keep our eyes on the goal here, and that's to make sure that every child is reading and learning and writing at grade level, and that's what we're focused on. And you're right. I mean, there have been a series of stories that come out, and what I can say about that is that, you know, we've gotten a request, and we will 100% comply with that, and it'll be my job as board president to ensure that we do that, and as a board as a whole. Right. I mean, I'm incredibly humbled that my colleagues would entrust me with this responsibility. And that's why we run. That's why we get elected to serve. And I'm looking forward to a great year. And I've got a couple of ideas that I'm going to work with my colleagues on bringing forward. This actually just yesterday, we announced a joint use agreement with the city of Fresno on opening up schools for green space, particularly in areas that are deemed park deserts, so to speak. And what the great thing is about that is that it's not just simply opening up schools. It's also including some recreational opportunities for the communities around. We'll have fitness trainers. We'll have some health programs. That's one of the issues that, you know, we'll be working on this upcoming year. Another piece that I know is a priority for my colleagues as well is the vocational training programs that we will be focusing on this upcoming year. And, you know, I'm talking about welding programs, plumbers, vocational areas that, you know, traditionally have not been focused on in the last 15 years as an educational system. And I think we need to work on those. And I'm sure there'll be other opportunities to come on your show and speak about that as those ideas materialize.
I want to ask you more about the parks story a little later on. Sure. But before we go back to that, I've heard it expressed by a number of people who watch the district closely or involved in the district. They say, you know, there are challenges out there. This latest issue of this investigation into the school contracts, it's concerning. But they have an equal concern in that it overshadows the good work the district is doing. I've heard people say, you know, Superintendent Hansen may have his challenges and people may like him or not like his leadership style, but that there's a lot of good that has gone on in the district in the past few years. Do you fall into that camp? Do you think that all of this talk about the administration is overshadowing the day-to-day work on the campuses and progress there?
Well, I think that's something that as a district we need to do a better job, right? I mean, every district across this country has its challenges, but we've also had some positive stories come out. A good example of that is the 81% graduation rate that we now have for Fresno Unified. Big urban school district, the fourth largest in the state. That's a plus. Now, what we need to do is build on that, right? So we know that 8 out of 10 students graduate, but the questions that I think we need to ask is, what's the plan for those students that are graduating, and how do we get those 2 out of the 10, the 20% that are not graduating, to graduate? And another area that I think we've done a really great job is on the redesignation of English learners, issue very near and dear to me, as I was an English learner at one point. We've had a 17% redesignation rate for our EL students in the district, and that's one of the big projects that we're going to be working on. We're updating the English Learner Master Plan. And as you know, Joe, that's one of the criteria that the new additional dollars that have come down from the state require us to invest in. So we've had a series of victories, so to speak, and what we need to do is build on those and make sure that we provide those opportunities for all of our students in the district.
At the same meeting last week when your colleagues elected you school board president, you were among a majority of five school board members who voted to grant a contract extension for Superintendent Hansen. Some people in the community sort of scratched their heads at that. Why did you choose to vote that way?
Well, I think when you're in this position and you evaluate an individual, you have to do a 360 evaluation of their performance, right? You've got the academic side, you've got the performance side, you've got the fiscal side. And in my mind, I've had a good working relationship with our superintendent, particularly the area that I represent, where we've done some great projects. And that's what I deem my evaluation on. But, everybody's entitled to their opinion. And I think when you're in that position, you're right. You're going to have individuals that like you and individuals that don't like you. But for me, what's important is that we keep focused on making sure that we're actually improving a lot of those graduation rates, that we're expanding the services and programs for our kids. And that's what I like to focus on during my tenure there as board president this upcoming year.
Facilities are a big concern for Fresno Unified for many years, for decades. The district lagged behind in that area recently. The most recent school bond allowed the district to make big improvements at many campuses. There's talk about another bond. Do you think that the most recent discussion and concern about the district's handling of school construction contracts and these allegations about the district's leadership in this area, does this potentially put that sort of an effort in jeopardy when it comes to putting something like that before voters?
Well, one of the things we did at our last board meeting is we actually hired a firm to do some polling in the community and kind of gauge exactly what you're describing, Joe. Now, I will tell you that, I mean, for me personally, I wasn't there the last time that the district went through this bond conversation. But I think what we have in front of us is if we do decide and we do see that there is a sentiment for support out there in the community, then this will be a great opportunity to really bolster and improve our contracting processes. And I think that, you know, the main thing that folks want to feel is that there's confidence in electeds being good stewards of taxpayer dollars. We have an oversight committee. I think we can do some improvements there on the level of scrutiny and their involvement in the spending of these dollars. So there'll be all these opportunities for us to have this conversation. But I can tell you that the bottom line is that, and I say this not just as a board member, but as a parent of children in the school district, is that every single child in this district deserves a safe, clean, and productive learning environment. And we have over $1 billion in needs across our district, from South Fresno to North Fresno, that are in desperate needs of improvements. And I'm looking forward to that conversation.
You have a lot of employees, a lot of teachers. I run into them occasionally now and then, talking to them off air and on air. And one of the concerns that I hear from teachers is concerns about classroom safety, about discipline, those sorts of things. This is not a new issue. It's been well documented out there. Most recently, there was an instance of an assault on campus. A student hit a teacher at Bullard High School. It took some time for that to be reported to the Fresno Police Department, who eventually did show up. How concerned are you about teacher safety and this issue of school discipline? There's been a push nationally and statewide to stop suspensions for willful defiance, to reduce the school-to-prison pipeline, and to change the way the real get-tough policies on school discipline. How do you feel the district is doing in that area in light of concerns like that?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because what we've done here recently is, and this will be the goal, we've now budgeted some resources in our partnership with the city of Fresno, particularly the police department, on making sure that we have a police officer at every middle school and every high school to attend and prevent a lot of these incidents that you described. What we'll be looking at this upcoming year is on making the assessment, not just for our local police officers in the schools, but also our campus aides, and really looking at that ratio. how many campus assistants do we need at a particular campus? And obviously there'll be a couple of factors that we look into that, but I'm sure that every single one of my colleagues would agree that safety needs to be the number one priority for our teachers. And I can tell you that as a teacher that worked in the classroom, it was challenging to have students with behavioral issues, and we have to be very cognizant of the fact that there are certain actions taken by a student, you know, where, yes, they're disruptive in the classroom and they have, you know, they either talk on their phone or they're talking to friends. That is a very different action than a student that physically assaults a teacher or another student. So we have to be able to separate those two. And it's interesting because educational code that governs our educational process really delineates what offenses are deemed no tolerance, and then what offenses you can actually work with what you describe willful defiance. So we'll be having a very in-depth conversation about campus safety, security, and then also the infractions that students can make. But I will tell you that for me personally, I don't have tolerance for a student that physically assaults a teacher or another student. And I think those are services that those students need that perhaps need to be had elsewhere. But, I mean, obviously it'll be on a case-by-case basis.
We have just a few minutes left. I want to return to the big announcement yesterday. You're partnering with the City of Fresno and also Central Unified School District to open up, in this case, 7 campuses by March to the public on weekends for additional community recreation, especially in communities where they lack a park space. How is this going to work, and why did it take so long to open those gates and let the community use that green space?
Sure. I'm really excited. It was a great day yesterday. Everybody always talks about that government doesn't communicate or collaborate. This is a great example of those partnerships that we have in our community, where we will be opening up a series of schools, actually be a total of 16 by May of this upcoming year. And you know, these discussions occur all the time, but what we focused on, and I'll tell you on my end, one of the things that has been beneficial of me working for Councilmember Quintero and then being on the school board are these types of partnerships where one will have additional green space. The second part is that we're not just simply opening up the gates. We're actually providing a series of programs there, health, fitness, and activities. And then the third piece, I think, is what our community wants. It's a safe environment. We've made investments in high-definition cameras, additional lighting. And I can tell you that as a parent, there's no better peace of mind than knowing that your child is going to go to a location that is safe. So this is a partnership that I think is the beginning of the first series of steps that we'll take. But another big thing that is of interest related to this is that the City of Fresno will be undertaking what's called a Parks Master Plan this upcoming year. And what I hope to replicate is this model that we announced yesterday across our city, because we know that there are neighborhoods that are park deserts where they don't have facilities. And this ties in directly to the challenges we have with youth having too much time on their hands and not having enough places to go, or then they get involved in gangs and drugs and vandalism. And I really feel that this will be a great measure on preventing a lot of those challenges, because as we all know, you know, it's not just about suppression, it's about intervention and prevention, and this is one piece of that puzzle, so to speak.
Luis Chavez is the new president of the Fresno Unified School District Board of Trustees, the largest school district in Central California, and a former classroom teacher. He joins us on Valley Edition today. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org. You can also send us a tweet. We are on Twitter, @KVPR and @Valley Edition. Subscribe to our podcast. We're online at kvpr.org, and you can also find our audio archives, read past stories, find photos and multimedia from our local reporters like Ezra David Romero and Deanna Aguilera and Jeffrey Hess. We thank them for their contributions to our program. Also, our audio engineer Marv Allen and production and operations manager Don Weaver. I'm Joe Moore for Valley Public Radio. We'll see you again next week.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment, Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.